think they call the legal book Black's Law. And see, what they do, folks, is they teach you to think in language. Once you're taught to spell and you're taught to view words as something that is written down, then the words have a power over you. But it's a spell, it's a glamour.
Ladies and gentlemen, to Amandla, your weekly news show with analysis and briefings about the continent of Africa. I'm Doug Miller here with Gwen Schulman, here in Zooming time from our homes. And we've got a full evening. I'm going to talk about a dear old friend who passed away just last week, Clyde Sanger, a very famous journalist from the post or the end of the colonialism, the nationalist period, and into the beginning of independence in many countries of East, Southern, and Central Africa. And as well, of course, there's the Africa Cup, and Malawi lost, damn it. But anyway, Gwen, what are you going to be talking about?
Well, I'm going to be following up on what we looked at last week. So last week, I interviewed Anuradha Mittal of the Oakland Institute on a recent report that they put out called Stealth Game, which exposed the impact of privatized and neocolonial wildlife conservation by one of Kenya's largest conservation agencies called Northern Rangelands Trust, or NRT, on indigenous pastoral communities, primarily in northern and coastal Kenya. So that's what we looked at last week. And then subsequent to that, the Oakland Institute hosted a webinar where called Elevating Voices, How Community Conservancies Devastate Land and Lives in Northern Kenya. So this webinar took place last week, and I was able to listen in on it, and they very kindly shared their audio with us here at Amandla. And so I edited out some of the, or brought together some of the voices, well, all of the voices, all of the participants in the webinar, and brought some of the highlights of what they had to say. So we're going to be bringing their voices forward today. And I'd just like to introduce to you who you are going to be hearing. They're not individually identified during the webinar, but these are the people that you'll be hearing. There's Anuradha Mittal, who you will hear midway through. She was the moderator of the session, and midway through, she kind of asks one of her summarizing questions of the participants. You'll hear her voice later. But in the meantime, you will be hearing Mordecai Ogata, who is the co-author of The Big Conservation Lie and Executive Director of Conservation Solutions Africa in Kenya. You'll be hearing Violet Matiru, Executive Director of the Millennium Community Development Initiatives in Kenya. She's also a zoologist, worked for Wildlife Kenya for a while, has become a great resource for land defenders in Kenya. As well, the voice of Major Abdinur Dima Jilo, who's with the Burana Council of Elders in Isiola, Kenya. You'll also be hearing Fiore Longo, who is a research and advocacy officer, Survival International, Director of Survival International in France and Spain. And then last but not least, Jeff Lecoupe, who is an independent journalist in Kenya. So that was the panel. These are the voices that you are going to hear.
To start with, I'd like to just point out that the dispossession of indigenous communities of their land that is happening under NRT is a culmination of a long-term strategy by the U.S. government, especially through USAID. The U.S. government and the European Union countries have been involved in the systematic destruction of indigenous institutions for the conservation of wildlife and other natural resources here in Kenya. The main focus has been to make wildlife a commodity, either for tourism, especially for rich white people, or even for hunting. Unfortunately, right from the beginning, the Kenya Wildlife Service was created by the political elite and handed over to the descendants of the British settlers, led by Richard Leakey, who proceeded to fill each key position with white people. The U.S. government supported key programs through Kenya Wildlife Service to achieve the turning of wildlife into a commodity. From 1992 to 1998, it supported the COBRA project, Conservation of Biodiverse Resource Areas. Then this was followed by the CORE program, which was Conservation of Resources Through Enterprise, which was funded by USAID from 1999 to 2005. The Biodiversity Conservation Program, on the other hand, was funded by the European Union from 1998 to 2006. These programs promoted the concept of communities setting aside land for conservation, also known as conservancies. The initial conservancies were established in the category of land that were registered as group ranches. And this is a category of land that was introduced by the World Bank that led to a lot of pastoral communities losing their land, especially when these group ranches were subdivided and the land was sold to outsiders. Communities, especially in Kajiado County, really suffered the most because of the proximity to Nairobi and the high demand for land. Therefore, the Kenya Wildlife Service has never been an organization that serves the needs and aspirations of indigenous Kenyans. It has always been a vehicle through which communities are dispossessed of their land and or turned into squatters on their land. A classic case which Andy will post on the chat, a classic case that demonstrates the involvement of the Nature Conservancy in the dispossession of communities of their land is when the Nature Conservancy gave $2 million to the African Wildlife Foundation to purchase land that was then known as Ellen Downs, which belonged to the former president, Moi. And this land was subsequently transferred to the Kenya Wildlife Service and named the Laikipia National Park. The Samburu community that claimed that this was their ancestral land were later slapped with the cost of the court case, and Kenya Wildlife officials would confiscate their livestock and harass them. The U.S. government has continued to fund the Nature Conservancy to acquire more and more land from communities and turn it into exclusive zones for rich white tourists. Communities are then supposed to be satisfied with pocket change that they get from selling beads, dancing for tourists, and being waiters and guides for the tourists. TNC has co-opted key government officers into the board of directors of NRT, including the Kenya Revenue Authority Commissioner of Intelligence and Strategic Operations. And this is in a brazen act of impunity, whereby there's a clear conflict of interest between these officers serving in their capacity as government agencies, as opposed to them serving in a non-governmental organization that is not answerable to the communities they serve. TNC then fundraises from the U.S. government, gullible Americans, and greedy investors, and uses the funds to steal land and other natural resources from the communities. Currently, TNC controls 50 million acres of land in Africa. Western governments know that aid is a weapon. As Boris Johnson, the current Prime Minister of Britain, said, aid corrupts, distorts, and infantilizes, makes people like children. As you can see, some of the people defending NRT don't even know how it's registered, but they just take it like it's gospel truth. It is not by accident that NRT is dispossessing communities of their land. It is by design, and USAID is providing the resources to facilitate this to happen. What has changed? The thing that has changed is that communities are refusing to be robbed. And another thing that has changed is that there is now very high access to information. Most Kenyans have a smartphone and have access to the internet. So communities are sharing information. They are talking to each other about the kind of injustices, and the communities are saying no to Western imperialism and the grabbing of natural resources from them for the sake of Western interest.
What is happening right now is this model is collapsing under the weight of its own intellectual weakness, if you can call it that. And what has been going on has been hidden in plain sight. Like, I can say for sure, there's no single piece of land in Kenya with the name NRT on the title deed. They're much stealthier than that. What they're exercising is control. And what they're exercising is control by diminishing and completely eliminating the individual, now referring to people as communities instead of referring to someone by name and their own aspirations, etc. And that places a platform on which human rights can be violated. The other thing is that the way the funding model works is that performance of funders is measured on how much money they give out, and the credit to organizations is measured by how much money they can take in. And what is being funded and sold all over the world, not just Northern Kenya, is narratives. Conservation is just narratives, like carbon credit. Those are all narratives. Net zero, all these narratives, which it turns out to be something like money laundering, because it's money changing hands and no outcomes, no proper outcomes coming the other way. And the type of attacks that happen underscore the role of racism in everything that's going on here. Because even when the Oakland report came out, it wasn't anything new that black researchers hadn't said, but the panic that you see now is because it came from an organization in the West. I've even read a part where Anuradha is attacked on her racial background, on why she's talking about this. I've been attacked on why I, as someone from Western Kenya, is talking about Northern Kenya. And that shows the weak basis of this thing. So what is happening now is that it's collapsing. And those who claim that NRT have no problem, then they need to ask themselves why the donors are investigating anything if there's no problem. Why are we here? Why are they here if there's nothing of consequence we are discussing here? So we need to look at where we want to go as a nation and as a people, because we're entering into agreements that are restricting people's use of their own lands over periods of 25 years. In many parts of Kenya, 25 years is enough for a child to be born, grow up, and have children of his or her own under an agreement in which they had no part and which governs their everyday lives. I personally have been victim of some of these attacks where some people have recently said my family is part of the people who've been poisoning livestock in Northern Kenya. A ridiculous claim, but this shows the desperation, and it's an idea whose time has come. Even the Roman Empire fell when its time came. The Soviet Union fell when its time came. This one will also fall down. And I think what we need to have in place right now is an intellectual structure that will take our people forward, managing their resources for their own sake. Tourism should only be a byproduct of conservation. It should never be the purpose for conservation. And there is no indigenous language in Africa that has a word for conservation, because that's just the way we lived. Conservation is a concept produced by destructive societies. And we cannot take this neoliberalism into management of shared resources. It's a recipe for fragmentation and violence.
Conservation has a colonial past, has a colonial present, and will have a colonial future if they don't listen to the people and they keep insulting whoever stand up against these human rights violations. If they do care about animals, they should be defending the right of indigenous peoples. 80% of biodiversity in the world is found on indigenous people territories, instead of building safaris on their land. This is what should be really happening. That said, and for me what's important is to mention that what we are hearing today, it's not just an isolated example. It's not just Kenya where NRT has done something wrong. These are ongoing issues all around the world. I have conducted extensive field research in the Koigo Basin and in India. I have been in communities with hunter-gatherer communities in the Congo Basin forest. I have been a lot of time with agriculture communities also in the tiger reserves, Livingside Tiger Reserve in India. And it's always the same thing. It's always the same model. This is a systemic a problem. Behind the conservation model that we are talking today, there is an ideology. That ideology is called racism. The funding for what today is happening in Kenya comes from the Western countries, as the same as everyone else in every other country I have to work. The agendas of environmental problems are set up in Brussels and in Washington, not in Kenya. This is where the money comes from. And we are talking about a white agenda that think that local people are not good enough to take care of their land, that a very special, perfect model of how the things should work have to be explained from by the white people to the people, the local people that are living in those countries. Otherwise, communities will collapse. There will be conflict between them because they don't know how to behave. And wildlife will be lost. And white people like wildlife because then they can go as tourists to the Kenyan Conservancy or other place and take pictures and be for, privileged enough to spend a night in one of the very, very, very expensive safari lodge. As I said, this money coming from the Western countries pay park rangers usually or support park rangers in different ways. Those park rangers are evicting the people from the land. I'm talking about the places I know. As I said, many countries of Congo Basin and India are evicting the people from their lands, are denying access because all of a sudden the land that were used, where they used to live, became a land where in some places they don't have any more access. They can't do any more of their things they have been doing for generations. And these same park rangers commit all sorts of violence. They kill the people, they torture the people, they rape the women. The problem is not just the human rights abuses here, which are of course horrible. The problem is that this is systemic and this is going on with taxpayer money from Western countries. The people like me that lives in Europe, we are giving our taxes and we are giving also donations to organizations that we think they're doing good. And it's very important to hear what they are really doing. And as I said, this is not just a matter of human rights, it's a matter also of taking care of the planet. If we really want to support conservation, we should be supporting the recognition of indigenous people's lands. There can't be any project of conservation that is done in lands where the indigenous people are living and they didn't have their right to the land. First, the first step is to recognize and to support the communities to get their right recognized. And then you can ask them how you can help them to protect their environment. This is not what's happening. It's not just, as I said, a matter of human rights abuses. It's that all this money is going away without any control. NRT or other 100 of WWF or WCS are getting all this money from, as I say, people like me, and no one is reporting. There is no controls. I know that because I have been working very close with other European Commission money going to this kind of project, and there was no control. When human rights abuses allegations were raised to them, they ignored them. Or they said, well, this is the price we have to pay for wildlife conservation. And this is the serious thing, that this is systemic and there is no control. And I think this is one of the things that from the people that are watching this from USA and from other and European countries, I think this is a very important point. This is happening because of us also. And it's our responsibility to take a stand and to stop this. And this is much more important, and this is my last point, because now the government, especially, as I said, European government, are pushing as a solution to climate change and biodiversity laws to turn the 30% of the earth into protected areas, into lands where indigenous people will lose the access and they will have their activities undermined. And this is their proposal. The proposal to save the planet today is let's turn the 30% of the planet into a protected area. Today we have 17% of the world as a protected area, including conservancies. Conservancies are also protected areas. And look what we have. The biodiversity loss is increasing, climate change is increasing, and we are violating the human rights of people. So before doing something like the 30%, there should be an investigation into if protected areas are working or not, and especially on the social and human rights impact of those protected areas. And I think this webinar is very important, especially because very soon we will be, most of countries will be agreeing on this 30%.
NRT always attempts to distance itself from the actions of community conservancy boards and claims that any decisions made were taken were made with the support from the communities. For instance, NRT says that the incorporation of a community conservancy can only be done by the community itself. Conservancies cannot operate or survive if they're not accepted by the community. What would your response be to that?
I want to respond like this. Here in Baringo, NRT came secretly and established conservancies where there was conflict. And they never involved the communities. They may have good intentions, but the manner in which they came is very interesting. I said, why are the pundits killing innocent people and displacing? If they were really pundits, why are they not even attacking the NRT Maneti conservancies? Why are they only interested in expanding to make sure that people get displaced from their lands? I want to respond to those defending NRT that most of those defending NRT and the illegal activities are most of the workers of NRT and other NGOs who fear losing the money they are getting, while we, the communities here, are suffering. Thank you.
Thank you, Zaya. Major Gillo?
In case of Isiolo County, the inception of Biliko Bulesa was actually done with the consent of one single person called Golicha Jarso, who was a former counselor. And there is no public participation at all at the inception of the conservancies by NRT. What they do, they handpick few people, some of them actually who are not indigenous to the county or to the area that they want to extend the new conservancy. They handpick, they promise that they're going to employ their sons, and you find the employees actually come from close relatives, because the entry point is through one person, and then is told, go and bring your relatives. And they are being told there is a vehicle that they are being given. So the youth are going to be employed. Now, this is how they start inducing people. And what the Isiolo communities are saying, first of all, the land should be registered as a block to allow continuity of the pasture communities use and access the pasture. They want the land to be subdivided, because the local communities are saying subdivision of land will actually give out their land in totality, and the use by wildlife and livestock will be undermined. So the land belongs to everybody. It belongs to the poor, and everybody has got equal rights on the land. So they want the land to be subdivided. And any use of the land, including mining and development, other developments, and also the conservancy, they said, first of all, the land must be registered. This is what NRT doesn't want. So the entry point is through an individual, and then his families. And very few people are the ones who are benefiting from the model of the NRT.
The initial conservancies were established in land that was already registered as group ranches. This was a category of land that the World Bank pushed to say that pastoralist communities can only economically develop if they have security of tenure. So they then introduced this category of land, which was communal. Certain groups, communities would then be registered, and it had a group ranch committees. Now, there were many problems of governance, and that resulted in a lot of people, a lot of communities getting dispossessed of their land because of the corruption of the committee. Those were the earlier conservancies. So at the end of the day, they were within the group ranch. The later conservancies have been established in land that was classified as trust land. These two categories of land, trust land and group ranches, have now all been brought under the Community Land Act. The problem with the trust land, those are lands that have never been what we call adjudicated. So they've never been registered in any form. They were held in trust by the local authorities. So what NRT does, NRT in these areas, which were former trust land, uses the lowest form of registration of a community organization, which is the community-based organization, which only requires 10 people. You get their details, their ID numbers, and you get them to sign a form. They take it to the Ministry of Gender and Social Services, the local office of the Ministry of Gender and Social Services, and they get a certificate because they've been registered as a CBO. Legally, a community-based organization registered like that is not considered a legal entity as per the way the law holds it in Kenya. Then NRT does something very interesting. It quickly registers a company in the name of that particular conservancy that has started off as a CBO. Now, when it registers a private company, a private company can sue and be sued. It can own property. It is considered by law a legal entity. So something that starts with minimal involvement of the communities, only 10 members, they can even go up to 50, but it's not the whole community, is then turned into something that then can even enter into contracts with investors for 30 years over this land that is not yet registered. And that's why the communities are asking, why not give the communities a chance to first register this land? Then they can decide as a community, can we enter into these deals? So those are some of the details that these supporters of NRT don't understand. I am a member of a WhatsApp group called Supporting NRT, where they are very abusive. They call me all sorts of names, but it also gives me a chance to see their level of understanding of what is NRT registered in Kenya as. They don't know.
In 2017, I was part of a team that did a study on the violent resource conflict with razors in Laikipia. And we found that 95% of the Samburu people who had come into Laikipia with their livestock were coming from conservancy areas, and they'd lost access to their dry season grazing areas. And when we wrote the draft report, NRT management called us into a meeting July 2017 in MS Hotel in Nanyuki and asked us to doctor that report. And this shows that we had hit the nail on the head even then. And this team included the then CEO and top management. So these are facts on the ground. It doesn't matter what people say. What is true, whether or not Auckland said it or not.
In the case of symptoms similar to those of COVID-19, such as fever, cough, sore throat, loss of taste, or smell, you should take a rapid home screening test. If you test positive, isolate yourself at home and please follow the self-isolation instructions. If you don't have a rapid home screening test, please self-isolate for the recommended period. Visit quebec.ca/self-isolating for complete instructions on how to protect yourself and others. A message from the Gouvernement du Québec.
Clyde Sanger died last Thursday, the 20th, at 93 years old, died peacefully and happily with his family around him. As you can tell, I'm quite attached to him. He was an old friend, and he was a leader and way ahead of all the rest of us in terms of being an activist around anti-apartheid. He was in Rhodesia working on the a journal down there for about 2 years, and finally fell afoul of the authorities. But coincidentally, he was then named to be the Manchester Guardian and Observer correspondent and sent to Nairobi to represent them. So with that, he came to Canada afterwards, and I spoke with my old friend David Beer, who also knew him quite well, and that's what you're going to hear is our recognition of Clyde and his contribution. What can you tell us about Clyde and why you think he's an important figure in African history and our relation with Africa?
Thanks, Doug. Well, Clyde was always there. He died last week at 93, which is incredible. And
absolutely.
50 years or more, he was connected to Africa. And you and I caught up with him 10 years later in the early 70s. But he was a mentor to us, a brilliant journalist. He was known to both the good guys and the bad guys in Central Africa, the Rhodesian whites and the liberation movement leadership, and to the allies of the liberation movements in Southern Africa in the 60s, 70s, and 80s.
He worked for the Manchester Guardian and the Observer.
Yes, he actually went to Rhodesia in 1958, I think, as editor of the Central African Examiner, which was nowadays you might say was a liberal organization, but in Southern Rhodesia was looked upon as left and a bit scary for anybody involved with it. And Clyde reported on issues out of Southern Rhodesia until 61, or was it 62, when he then moved to Nairobi and was the correspondent of the newspapers you just mentioned.
Yeah, so as such, as you say, he got to know, he was encyclopedic in the people he knew and could talk about and had met and interviewed, and just an amazing resource for people who wanted to know something.
he was a humble man. He would be in the middle of an amazing crisis and talking to the people involved, and he always came off as the quiet questioner, which was absolutely fantastic. And he had a wonderful sense of humor. He was a poet. He was a wonderful husband of Penny, and they had four boys, all within about 2 or 3 years. The first group was a pair of twins, and they grew up in Africa for a few years before they all came to the Glebe in Ottawa, where we certainly picked them up in the mid-70s. And in the Glebe, that family, the Sanger family, was quite a contributor to the events of the community of mid-central Ottawa.
Oh, yes. They really formed the backbone of the Glebe community. It was, and
yes.
Penny's funeral, because we could hold funerals back in those days, was just an amazing event with a big hall full of people and
yes,
tributes from Africa, from the Glebe neighbors and friends of all over. And Clyde, too, will get that same kind of ceremony.
I'm sure.
So I first met Clyde in 1972, so it was only five or six, 7 years after he came to Canada, and I'd arrived with my new partner Nelly from Malawi and my 8-month-old baby. But I was keen on anti-racism work, and I went to meet my friends at the CUSO office, and they talked about the Southern African Information Group that had been set up. And when we first met, there was Clyde, and it was clear from the beginning that he was one of the guiding lights, one of the thinkers behind it, the motors behind it. And we set up the Southern African Information Group newsletter, and Clyde, again as a journalist, supported our efforts in so many ways. He was there helping us collate when we put the thing together and lay out and write an editorial here and there. And it was really impressive to work with him in those days. When did you first meet him?
Well, I think it was also in 74. that when I moved back from Zambia to and lived in the Glebe, and that's where our families bumped into each other. But I think I knew him whilst I was in Lusaka. But I have two memories of him and myself together, quite momentous. One is Zimbabwe independence in April of 1980. We were sitting together in the high seats of Rufara Stadium on the night of the magical night when independence was declared, with the young prime minister about to be Mugabe, and a tremendous gathering of Commonwealth leaders, Kaundas and neighborhood frontline state people. And Clyde was there as a journalist. I think he might, I'm not sure whether he was with the Commonwealth Secretariat quite yet. And I was there on a CUSO journalist tag when I went to get my credentials from the officials of the still Rhodesian administration. I said I was with the CUSO Bulletin, and which was a modest handout for CUSO. And this white Rhodesian guy, he just thought, well, Canadian, it must be important. So I got my tag, and both Clyde and I were sitting up in the cheap seats looking down on the field. And that was a thrill. We were together again in Namibia 10 years later on the Canadian NGO observer group for the election, which happened in March of the following year, 2000, I guess. No, 1990.
Yes.
And there was a group of Flora McDonald and Shirley Carr from CLC and Mayor Brownstone from Oxfam. It was quite a good group. And we spent 2 weeks traveling, observing the registration of voters for the election to happen in 4 or 5 months' time.
And that's the transition from control of South Africa over Namibia, handing over Southwest Africa to the SWAPO party.
Yes, and we certainly were exposed and saw the regime in power, because they did a lot of things to knock that election off its feet. And Clyde was a tremendous addition, as we went from little village to big urban areas watching the election process. So Clyde and I were together numerous times, and particularly also in London, England, when he was with the Commonwealth Secretariat as the information officer.
I too have a couple of stories, but they're a little more vicarious. And that was that I interviewed him twice for different projects I was working on. And so I got to hear some old stories that he could tell about his experiences. While he was stationed in Southern Africa, it was the period of the late 50s as they were breaking up the Federation of Rhodesia and Nyasaland.
Oh, yes.
He was covering the news out of there, and his, I don't know what year the twins were born, but whatever that year was, he happened to be in Blantyre, and his partner Penny was coming back from the UK after delivering the twins. and there she is getting off the plane with her armload of baby things, diapers and whatever else one has to carry, and a baby in one arm. And who should precede her out the door with the other twin? Kamuzu Banda himself, as he is arriving in the country.
Oh my.
So he was very close to just about everybody who was a nationalist leader in Southern Africa, not just Rhodesia, but all over. He knew the leadership in Zambia, Tanzania, Malawi, South Africa, and so on. And they all knew and respected him as well, because he helped them in many ways. And the other
Well, there are many other stories I could tell, but at that point, I think that's a cute one about that time of his history. And he was a prolific writer, too. Once he came to Canada, he worked for IDRC, he worked for North-South Institute, he worked, a tremendous Commonwealth Secretariat, as you said. He was a correspondent for The Economist, The Globe and Mail, The Guardian. It never stopped.
And he had time to write little human stories, vignettes in the Glebe Report or in a magazine. And he also was a poet. And I do have a poem that he wrote that is in one of his poet combinations called All Ages. And he recounts, on first driving down Voortrekker Road in Achiwarango with David Beer. So that was reference to the Namibian.
The Namibian experience.
What you call it, we were all there. And he recounts, in the evening at the stadium, he's now recounting the Zimbabwe independence, the last colonial rattle, when the old judge who sentenced so many young men anointed the unassuming president, and then the police lobbed their tear gas into the crowd, swelling to hear the wailers. And that was Bob Marley.
Bob Marley.
But up in the bleachers, we cheered the army from the bush, and the whole night was singing. That's one stanza in that poem, and he captures the history and the character and the emotion. Yes. It's just fantastic.
And with that tremendous human overview that he brought to everything, it was always very human. And the judge who would have sentenced young Rhodesian blacks to death, and now he's anointing the government head as head of state, Robert Mugabe.
A great feature, Doug, is the publication of Clyde's last book just 2 weeks ago or a little bit more.
Can you believe it? 93 and he's still writing.
Our Golden Years in Africa, from Congo to Zimbabwe, Clyde Sanger. And it's the story of his life with Penny in Africa in the late 50s and early 60s, living in Rhodesia and in Nairobi. So it's a wonderful book of all kinds of photographs and vignettes and occurrences, and his love story with Penny.
Which oh my gosh, they were an amazing couple.
They were so sweet. They really were.
And it's a tribute to him. The four fine gentlemen that he raised as sons, Ooh. They raised as sons are in all involved and all very
active,
carrying on and active in their different ways. So well, David. Here's to Clyde Sanger.
Next time,
we get together, we'll raise our glasses to him personally, face to face. For now, it's just our coffee cups in the morning. Bye, Clyde. Hambakale, as they say in South Africa. Go well, old friend, old comrade. We know you've lived a full life and you went happily.
Peace and love.
Bye-bye.
Ciao.
Thank you, David. Well, the Africa Cup is on. And the first round is done, and it went to the knockout round of 16. That's still being played. Yesterday, I watched with great interest as Morocco and Malawi played, and Malawi just couldn't quite pull it off. They lost 2-1. A valiant effort. They did excellent in the first round, and held up a good side against Morocco. But Morocco clearly was a superior team with a skills levels and experience that carried them, but some spectacular plays on the part of Malawi. In fact, they got the first goal, and that put the Moroccans on their back foot. So it was a lot of fun to watch. Good game.
Well, Doug, I know that you were in touch with friends and family in Malawi. Just maybe describe to us their reaction.
The bars were full, and of course by the middle of the second half, as we were down and it looked like we were going to stay down. Then, of course, it was sniff, sniff as we got these little pictograms coming on WhatsApp. they recognized that Malawi just couldn't overcome the kind of teamwork and passing and ball control. It was something like 78% ball control in the first half gone to Morocco. So it just showed you that even though Malawi got a goal and it ended up at the end of the half 1-1, that Morocco nonetheless had the strength, and it was just going to be a matter of time. And now they're going to play in the semifinals. The semifinals are being lined up actually this afternoon, and before we broadcast, Egypt and Cote d'Ivoire are playing to set up the second part of that semifinals, and that will occur. The semifinals will occur on Saturday, and both games will be played. You can get them 11 o'clock and 2 o'clock here in Montreal time. But what I got is a little piece from Dolce Vella, which talks about the history. Where are the best players in Africa? Why do they seem to only come from certain countries? It's a bit long. And it's meant to be a little funny, but it's really quite interesting because it does give a historical perspective and put it clearly in the context of colonialism. So stay tuned.
Do you remember this press conference? It created a bit of a controversy, let's say.
In January, it's a little tournament in Africa.
A little tournament?
This comment on the Africa Cup of Nations wasn't exactly well received by some Africans.
I think you are the continent and apology.
A Nigerian journalist asked for an apology.
I wasn't the only one that saw it, you know, that took that as an insult. It went all over Africa.
The debate went on. Was Europe belittling African football?
It's ironic. There's still a tournament, a big one. We lose our best players to the African Cup.
Be that as it may, African football matters. Liverpool manager Jurgen Klopp isn't the only one who knows that. But wait a minute, why do we even use the term African football?
Is there a European football? A South American one? An Asian one?
No.
So let's not paint it all with the same brush. Let's rather look at how beautifully diverse African football is. And
what differentiates the various forms of African football, who dominates it, and why?
37 players from the Premier League were called up for the AFCON 2021. Mo Salah, Sadio Mane, Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang, and Riyad Mahrez, to name just a few. When it comes to these players' origins, almost all hail from North and West Africa. A few players buck the trend, like Aston Villa's marvelous Nakamba from Zimbabwe. The North and the West's dominance is not a new thing. Take the teams with the most Africa Cup victories from the past. Egypt, 7 times. Cameroon, 5 times. Ghana, 4 times. And Nigeria, 3 times.
Oui et non, parce que c'est un peu simpliste, un peu généraliste, si on veut. On généralise un peu trop.
In fact, just as there is no one football in Africa, there is also no one football in North and West Africa.
Si on prend le football marocain et algérien, il est assez proche. Le numéro 10 est toujours sacré au Maroc et en Algérie. Donc ce sont toujours des joueurs très techniques, peut-être pas forcément assez bons tactiquement ou physiquement, mais qui compensent par la technicité. Et quand on parle de l'Afrique de l'Ouest, ce n'est pas vraiment homogène. Par exemple, je peux penser à la Guinée, par exemple, qui a des joueurs très rapides. Mais quand on compare, par exemple, la Guinée à la Côte d'Ivoire, qui sont des pays voisins ou presque voisins, ce n'est pas du tout la même aptitude physique. En Côte d'Ivoire, c'est beaucoup plus costaud.
So, easy explanations apparently don't do the job. Maybe there are other reasons. Does culture play a role? Let's ask in Cameroon.
Comme dans des pays tels que le Brésil, on apprend à jouer très jeune, on joue très tôt au football. Étant donné que c'est un sport qui est facile à pratiquer, ça ne demande pas de moyens. Il faut un ballon, il faut deux poteaux, et puis on se met à jouer.
Right, but if it is so easy to play, why do other nations in Africa lag so far behind? This is Kenya in Eastern Africa, the most successful African nation at the Olympics with over 100 medals won.
Its national team never played at the World Cup and has missed more AFCONs than it actually played.
Kenyan footballers at top clubs? Hang on, Victor Wanyama was at Tottenham between 2016 and 2020. He's an exception to the rule, though. What is Kenya's and East Africa's problem? Kenyan Dennis Oliech, who spent 10 years playing in France, says
It has nothing to do with physique or similar, it's lack of exposure. East Africa is a virgin field for scouts and there is a lot of untapped talent.
But why the lack of exposure? What makes countries in Eastern Africa different?
Historiquement, la plupart des pays ont été colonisés par la Grande-Bretagne. Des sports comme le cricket ou le rugby ont dû batailler avec le foot. Donc, le football a très souvent été en concurrence avec d'autres sports. Ce qui n'a pas toujours été le cas en Afrique de l'Ouest, notamment au Cameroun, où le football est le sport roi.
So, are the varying levels of quality in African football also related to the colonial legacy? Listen up! Time for history class. On the beat,
French clubs started to recruit players from Morocco and Algeria as early as the 30s. Both countries were then under French rule. They also established transfer networks from the 50s onwards with West Africa. Portuguese clubs started recruiting from their colonies from 1949. And clubs in Belgium from what is today called DR Congo since the 1960s. And what about Britain? It didn't let players from its colonies in. A two-year residency qualification for non-British players meant foreigners could de facto only be amateurs. This rule lasted until 1978.
History class over. Well, kind of.
Hold it now!
So, Britain didn't bring East African players in. But why were former British West African colonies Nigeria and Ghana so successful then? Well, after independence, Nigeria was economically relatively stable. Its league was strong. Nigeria's national team won its first AFCON in 1980.
We used to have a black and white TV then, and whenever we don't have power supply, my dad would come with the car battery to generate power for the TV. I grew up seeing all that, the fans, the passion to watch our local players play in the league.
A league that used to be a big deal back in the day. The stadiums were filled up, league matches were reported daily on television, in the newspapers.
Nigerian football developed and the world slowly took notice. Nigerian players such as Stephen Keshi became pioneers when moving to Europe.
Imagine a player like that coming out of Nigeria. He inspired the others to also want to move to Europe. And that also was the beginning of the growth and the production of talent out of Nigeria, for example. And you know what it is when someone comes out of a community and does well in a particular field. You have other youngsters who want to emulate that person.
Many youngsters from Africa have done so since, inspired by their role models and seeking economic stability. Today, there are 46 Africans playing in the Premier League compared to only 17 South Americans. The overwhelming majority is from West Africa. It is these role models missing in Eastern Africa as here in Tanzania. And the Premier League has reinforced foreign player restrictions. Players from countries below 50th position in the FIFA rankings need to have a certain number of appearances in international club competition or a certain minimum transfer fee. Currently, Uganda is ranked 82nd, Kenya 102nd, Tanzania 131st as of early 2022. So, no real path to the number one league. Would you call that fair?
But then again, it's not just history and structure. Some say it's also about mentality.
The average Nigerian is much more ambitious than the average Kenyan. This is no disrespect to the Kenyans. That is the makeup of the Nigerian. We are dreamers. We are ambitious. We want to succeed.
This might sound a bit harsh, but just listen to what Eastern Africans say about this themselves.
West Africans are famously known for their Billy No Mates mentality. They have a unique fighting approach in all walks of life, says Kenyan analyst Kochecha S. Kochecha. And the Eastern African minds, on the contrary, are engulfed by the fear of failure, lack of courage, and timidness. Belgian anthropologist Noel B. Salazar quotes Tanzanians he interviewed, "Migration is not a very Tanzanian thing to do. They are not the most ambitious people, and they have a family to rely on."
So this issue, besides being historical and structural, seems to indeed be psychological as well.
But there are exceptions to this rule, like Mbwana Samata, a Tanzanian who made it to Premier League. Plus, his compatriots do not have to go that far. And this takes us to the promised land of football in Africa, the North.
Historiquement, les pays de l'Afrique du Nord étaient beaucoup plus de l'Europe, donc ils ont bénéficié d'une infrastructure et d'une proximité qui était géographique et historique. Donc il y a eu, si vous voulez, une institutionnalisation du football qui était beaucoup plus ancienne.
As mentioned, Morocco, Algeria and Tunisia have historical ties with France. In Egypt, football started to grow under the British occupation force. Egypt joined FIFA as the first African nation in 1923. It was also the first African country to play at a World Cup in 1934. Today, its league is going from strength to strength. And the passion is unreal. This is Al Ahly fans while their team are just training. And it's not just Egypt. Northern African League set the standard for the rest of the continent.
Les clubs sont gérés comme des sociétés. Les enjeux financiers ont surtout explosé. Moi, je pense par exemple à l'Égypte où les groupes médias privés sont prêts à mettre des millions et des millions de dollars, ce qui permet de retenir beaucoup plus les joueurs et de retenir les stars du continent qui viennent jouer en Afrique du Nord.
But when you look at the Northern Africans, it's still like that. Their leagues are still top-notch. And when you compare the league with the European standard, yeah, there's not much of a difference in it. The pay is fine. The administrative part of it is going well.
And this strength of North African clubs also translates into good results for their national teams. So, what about Southern Africa? Well, the Republic of South Africa is the only country able to match Northern Africa's level of organization and investment. The South African Premier Division is well run. Mamelodi Sundowns from Pretoria and Orlando Pirates from Johannesburg have both won the African Champions League. Another Johannesburg side, the Kaizer Chiefs, have a huge following and are the second richest club in Africa after Al Ahly. But
le revers de la médaille, c'est l'équipe nationale. Et pour moi, très sincèrement, je ne comprends pas qu'il y ait autant de moyens misés sur le championnat et qu'il n'y ait pas autant de moyens misés sur l'équipe nationale. Je ne trouve toujours pas la raison exacte pour laquelle la sélection de l'Afrique du Sud ne joue plus de Coupe du Monde.
Well, if the experts are short on explanations, what to expect from me then?
South Africa did not even qualify for the AFCON 2021. Plus, they're out of the World Cup in Qatar 2022. Central Africa, you ask? It's a similar story with former powerhouse DR Congo. In 1974, then as Zaire, they played at the World Cup. Around that time, they also won two AFCON titles. Today, this huge country of over 90 million people failed to qualify for AFCON 2021. Let's finish on a positive note. There are always fresh faces emerging in African football. Take Comoros, who sensationally qualified for the Africa Cup of Nations 2021. They are African football's latest fairy tale story. Population? 850,000. The Iceland of Africa? Not sure, but it shows one thing.
In Africa, les moyens se sont démocratisés, le football s'est démocratisé et ce n'est plus réservé à une certaine caste. La vérité du terrain, elle est absolue et c'est cette démocratie-là qui est la seule vraie démocratie de l'Afrique en fait. C'est les 11 contre les 11 qui arrivent sur le terrain et c'est la meilleure histoire du football africain et on l'aime comme ça. Donc, on veut surtout pas que ça change, on veut que ça reste comme ça. C'est son charme.
Là, c'est imbattable, je peux plus. Là, t'as tout dit.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, that's it for Amanda this week. We've been here, Gwen and I, again with our show. We hope that you've gotten something out of it, and we plan to be back next week, same time,
Same station, so stay tuned to Jazz Euphorium.
C'est maintenant le temps de prendre votre rendez-vous pour votre dose de rappel contre la COVID-19. Allez sur québec.ca/vaccin-COVID pour suivre la séquence de vaccination prévue dans votre région et prendre votre rendez-vous en ligne. Pour bien vous protéger contre la COVID-19 et ses variants, vous devez recevoir la dose de rappel et continuer de respecter la distanciation, de porter le masque et de laver vos mains. La dose de rappel, un moyen de nous protéger plus longtemps. Un message du gouvernement du Québec.
Good evening, this is Jazz Euphorium YCQ here at 90.3 with Mr. Sad Tonight.